what do we think? Where are we at? How's the world?
Wow. Oh, God. Do we have to go there?
Do we have to? Yeah. I'm not going to review the world today.
No, we've already got one bleak.
One star. Wouldn't go back.
Yeah.
Do we start with the conversation of if this is the best comic book movie or not? Or do we save that for later?
I think we will save that for later. But yeah, definitely let's focus on this dystopian future that, you know, James Mangold. The one James Mangold presented us
the
with.
The one we're living in.
Yeah.
The one where semis are driving themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not far.
That's quite nearby, I would think.
I would think so too. This is the third time we're gonna do this. A marathon on part threes,
part tray.
Yeah, pretty exciting. These have gone well in the past, I think.
These are always a lot of fun.
It's kind of interesting to just check in on a franchise out of context, especially a part three.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure some of the
movies...
Which
is where they get great or go off the rails.
Totally,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. That's why it's kind of fun to hone in on those. Yeah, and again, some of these will probably be, you know, this movie is an ending. You know, it's a conclusion, but I'm sure we'll look at some part threes that are a placeholder for more to come.
So right. And I think, yeah, it really does something that it does from its source material insofar as it ends things, but stands alone and doesn't, you know, there's no sense in thinking that this is a permanent ending, you know, by any stretch. So,
well, yeah, I did, as I was watching this with some friends, as we get this really kind of incredible ending, this really good final shot, I think good final shot,
mm-hmm.
Kind of this mournful score and final Logan title, I couldn't help but say Wolverine will be back in Deadpool 3, which does really sort of take the piss out of this movie a little bit.
Yeah.
And it sounds like even when they were doing the promotion of this movie, there was an inkling that he was flat out lying out there.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like the possibility of a return has been in the works for some years.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's from a meta text standpoint, it is kind of interesting.
Which makes sense, because in comic books, the only people who stay dead are Uncle Ben and Bucky. Oops.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then Jason Todd, right? Like right, for every example you have, they've probably come back at least once.
Yeah. I think Uncle Ben stays dead. I think that he's the only one left.
Really
now.
Undercuts the backbone of the Spider-Man character if he does come back.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking like a Truman Show.
Him and Bruce's parents.
With the peer, and he's coming back.
Well, I think there's an alternate reality Bruce's dad, where Bruce's dad became Batman. He showed up before. Yeah, it's...
Oh, yeah,
comic
that's...
Books are
yeah,
weird,
yeah,
man.
Yeah.
What a weird medium.
There's only so many stories you can tell with a character before you just... have to get weird with it, I suppose.
Well, and that's the idea in comics, right? Is it you're thinking about these characters in new kinds of circumstances and situations. It really does sort of play off fandom. I mean, that's why cons became a thing.
Well, and
right?
To get us to this movie specifically, I think it takes about 20 years rounding up worth of X-Men movies and worth of Hugh Jackman playing this character across multiple iterations of the franchise. I think it takes that investment from the studio, you know, they have to see a big return on that character time and time again for them to be like, oh, okay, I guess we could, yeah, do something a little off the beaten path, do something a little bit more adult, or at least something that's gestures towards being more adult. We'll talk about how successfully this is a film for grown-ups.
We would definitely do that. But hello, everybody, and welcome again to the Good Trash Genre Cast, where we gather around a table and we discuss the films you'll never discuss in a film today's course. Today's film is the first film in our new marathon, Part Threes, Part Trey, in which we are doing the third iterations and sequels. And we're starting off with James Mangold's Logan, starring one huge jacked man. And I'm going to have a good time with that. I'm still Dustin.
I'm still Arthur.
I am still Dalton.
And we're here to talk about this movie in an analytical kind of fashion. That does indeed mean spoilers. So if you have not seen Logan from 2017, we want to warn you that we will spoil the film, but we'll wait till the halfway point roughly of the show to begin doing that. What it'll look like before that is we'll have a synopsis, which will be spoiler free, then we'll move on to a thumbs up, thumbs down reviews short section, in which we just do what they do in reviews, talking about whether we like it or not, and although the plot may be part of that, the ending will not. Then we move on to a little game called Expanding the Syllabus, which might involve the vaguest of spoilers, And then finally we get down to business. There'll be music to let you know that business has been gotten down to. And that's when all spoiler bets are off. So that's your spoiler warnings all the way through for that. With all of that, I go to you now, Mr. Arthur Gordon. Do you have a synopsis with which to delight us?
Time has not been kind to the once legendary Wolverine. The adamantium in his body is slowly poisoning him. Logan desires to get his mentor and friend Charles Xavier out of society to keep humanity safe. But when a pleading nurse shows up with a strange young girl, Logan will have to remember what it is to be a hero one more time.
Very good, very good. Yep. I mean, that is what happens in the film. It's an Old Man Logan movie. Based on Old Man Logan, so...
Not really.
Not really, but, you know...
In name alone.
Yeah, kind of inspired.
Yeah, Mark in Millar theory. Adjacent. Yeah. So...
Yeah, but also more inspired by the X-23 stories.
What if Logan was old?
Yeah.
Yes.
Boom, you got
and
it.
Adamantium poisoning. What if that was a thing?
And yeah. Tired, like
and,
me.
And tired. Yes. So, with that, I guess we'll run around the table and do thumbs up, thumbs down reviews. I'm going to go to you first, Arthur, as I look upon your left forearm... Do you like this movie?
Look upon my arm in delight.
You're extremely sick, Logan tattoo.
Yeah, I like this movie. I think when we did our best of whatever year this was, 2017, it made my list probably pretty high. I don't remember. I didn't check the numbers. I didn't go back to the stat book.
It might have been your top movie, it if might I recall. Have been.
Time is a thing. It was 6 years ago.
It's a construct.
Yeah, an absurd one is the well. Yeah, I like this movie. I think that it is refreshing as a comic book movie, if we are going to genre-tize that, that it doesn't feel beholden to a house style like every other comic movie, Marvel or otherwise, since 2008. And it also still feels different from whatever DC was doing with their gritty, grim, dark, restructuring with Snyder. It very much feels like its own thing, and it feels like a natural evolution of what Mangold, I think, has wanted to do with the character. We saw him first take the reins with the Wolverine, which I think a lot of the DNA for this movie is there before it becomes a quote-unquote comic book movie in the third act. Mm-hmm. This, I think, gets to remain a little more true to a vision not beholden to setting up future storylines and bringing in extra characters and bridging the gap between different whatevers. It really gets to be Logan's final story in a way that's very, I think, fulfilling, especially for people who have watched that character for almost 20 years. I mean, X-Men comes out in 2000, and 17 years later, here we are with the Logan. And, Hugh Jackman's obviously... hard to separate from Wolverine at this point. Mm-hmm. I mean,
big time.
After 20 years, it's really hard not to think Hugh Jackman when you think Wolverine. Other than height, I mean, he's got a great look. I mean, especially once he got jacked, right? I mean, when you go back and look X-Men, and like, he's not jacked, but at a point he gets jacked.
As soon as you said the Wolverine, I was like, I just thought of those production stills. The reason to promote the movie where he's just shredded.
He hasn't had water in like 3 days.
Yeah, and he's just so dehydrated.
He's just popping every muscle. It is hard, though. I mean, the look, the hair, the sideburns, and we get all that kind of here again one last time, which is fun. But he's great in the role. I mean, he's certainly owned it over the years. The anger, the pain, the hurt, the tired, all he wears it all very well. I think the makeup, the costume, the hair stuff, you know, making him look much older and much more tired than he actually is, I think works very well. I think the star is Patrick Stewart, who you know, I think if this comes out post Black Panther, he probably gets, you know, at least some awards nominations, if not a few wins.
Interesting. Yeah.
Because, maybe. I mean, there's still a stigma, I think, before Black Panther.
Yeah.
You know, this gets a Joker screenplay nomination. Yeah, with Joker.
I always forget this got in the Best Adapted Screenplay
nomination. Yeah. And so I do think they probably take Stewart's performance a little more serious a couple years later because it's just some heartbreaking moments. I don't want him to be chemically castrated. I don't.
Yeah.
I want him to be Charles and do what Charles does.
Mm-hmm.
and the kind of weird found family organization that gets set up here, and you know, they've so on the nose pointed out of, oh, he's my father, she's my daughter, and we get to, but from that first movie, the I think the chemistry between Jackman and Stewart has always been really great.
Yeah.
But here now, it just feels so lived in because we've gotten to see them do this so many times and in such a sincere way that it all works. The action's good. I mean, nerfing Wolverine, he's old, he's tired. His claws aren't coming out like they need to. He's got, you know, projectile dysfunction, getting those out.
okay. All right. I like that. That's good. Jesus.
I mean, he has to like, you know, he pulls it out and he slices
so
his hand.
Brutal. Ugh.
He's just not healing. And I think those little moments, it works so well. And the tone, I tried watching the noir part of cut of this, and I don't think the black and white works.
I haven't seen it, but it doesn't seem like this is the movie that lends itself to that.
And the colors are so good.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really good color grading. You know, movie. I was reading, you know, Matt Singer points out, you know, noirs are nighttime stories usually, and this is broad daylight, you know, hot Mexican sun type stuff, and it doesn't lend itself to that. And it's a Western.
Yeah.
And so I finished it out in color, and I mean, it just looks great. You know, visually, it's very simple. We don't have huge CGI set piece. I mean, a lot of in the nature, running through the woods, fighting bad guys with guns. Mm. We got a lot of digital, I'm sure, blood splatter and body parts falling off and superpowers coming out. But by and large, it's real clean in that way. But yeah, I think the thing of Logan's always been a bit selfish, resistant to help people. And here, you know, one last time, Charles has to encourage him to save the day, to be Wolverine and do what he knows he's supposed to do. And that kind of back and forth between them is really interesting. So I really like this movie. I think it just sings on so many levels. That great little piano score, real slowed down, is cool. Laura Daphne Keene's really cool. She gets to be really fun here. Her action stuff is really, really fun too. She's so fast and snappy, which is a nice contrast to the slow, clumbering Wolverine who's limping and trudging along in the wake of her usually. Stephen Merchant's good as Caliban. He's fun.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a good cast. Our villains get to be fun.
Richard E. Grant, really fun.
A lot of mustache twirly kind of stuff is good.
On the subject of Caliban, I don't really remember this character at all. Maybe you don't either.
No, I think
he doesn't look probably what you think he.
Caliban's a character in the comics, but I think he's got somebody else's powers. They needed a character that could track other mutants.
Because as I was watching this, I was like, I don't know this thing at all, and I'm not familiar with this sort of albino, you know, photosensitive.
I think he generally looks more
like a beast, kind of.
I think there's been a few different iterations, but.
Okay, yeah. Okay, well, moving on then. I just was curious because I was like, I don't really know that character.
But they needed a tracker. So they got a tracker.
Bingo.
If you got a Western, you need somebody that can track.
That's right.
I've seen enough Westerns to know how it works. Classic trope there. It works as a Western. It works as an action movie. It works as an X-Man story. I think it just soars, and I appreciate it. I love it. I like it a lot. I think about it a lot. And so, Logan rocks.
Yeah. Well, as the kids might say. I thought that might be what you would say there, Arthur.
It'd be real bad if I like done a total 180 on it and hated it.
Like, I hate this awkward worst movie. It's like,
that would have surprised me.
I'm getting laser removal right away.
Stat.
Dalton, do you like Logan?
I do. I also had it. I went ahead and went to the numbers.
He also went and got a tattoo.
No, I didn't. I've every time I've thought about doing it, I'm, you know, too scared of what if I need $200, $300 for something else and talk myself out of it. It was my number 5 of 2017. Yeah, I like this movie a lot, and on rewatch still do. I had a busy week, so I had to watch this in multiple chunks. But that did not rob it of any of its dramatic power for me. I really just was key. Every time I sat down to watch, you know, a half hour, 45 minutes of this, it was really working for me. I am going to echo a lot of what Arthur said. You know, I think it definitely works more as a Western than as a superhero movie, although it's definitely indebted to both genres pretty heavily. For me, it's interesting. You know, the violence of this film is certainly one of its calling cards. That's definitely a big talking point around this movie, both in terms of its, release, but also its production. You know, when you watch some of the behind-the-scenes footage, they definitely talk a lot about taking a different approach to the on-screen violence than had ever been done with Wolverine. And, you know, for all of that and all that can be made of that, I think what really makes this movie click is character interaction, is dramatic stakes, is just a competently made, structured, and photographed film. Now, I have quibbles. You know, I think the Munson family gets done dirty, and we'll probably talk about that in analysis. I like those characters, and I think the movie can't quite figure out what to do with them except make them fodder. And
well, that's a nod to Shane. That's like a plot point of Shane.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and so it's sort of just recreating that as an event that... And
how could you bring this to this home kind of thing?
Yeah, mm-hmm. and then he's sort of dropped in the middle of that story there. And then, so you've got, the farmer and the big corporate,
I figured that was... Yeah.
Yeah, that's the Shane bit. And then we just, in addition, we're going to add the baddies that are trying to find our ex-friends.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know. It works in a terms of a very tragic note in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it just feels like these characters get done a disservice by the screenplay. It's just like, oh, well, that's unfortunate. Because there is, we are setting up to have kind of an interesting sort of very, cliche maybe would be the right word, kind of Western standoff with the corporate ranchers. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, with some quibbles aside, I really do go for this movie. The performance is just there. You know, he's had a long time to think about this character, and it really is quite a good performance. And you don't usually associate these kinds of movies with really good acting. I mean, it definitely... that's been a hallmark of, the last several years of superhero movies is committed performances, getting a lot of mileage out of these movies. But this one really, I feel like, kind of takes it up another notch. It definitely, mm-hmm. if they all tried this hard, I'd still be a little bit more interested in the genre, I feel like. And that's the highest compliment I can pay this film, is that it really does make you go, oh yeah, you can make good movies out of this stuff. Yeah, really works for me. I like Boyd Holbrook a lot too. We haven't talked about him yet. He's fun. Nice and smarmy.
Mm-hmm.
Just a real good, third tier villain dipshit. To be the heavy until we meet the guy he works for. Really great sort of character. The robot limbed mercs, we don't really do much with them other than they're just kind of the one throwaway line to kind of draw a this parallel between the use of mutant characters for military purposes and the use of technology to enhance human soldiers. We kind of draw this through line between these human mercs and Wolverine, and then that, you're not the only one that's been enhanced throwaway line, but we don't really do a whole lot with him other than it's cool to have a bunch of cyborgs
yes
be the guys that Wolverine's fighting, which I'm fine with, but definitely it's like a really interesting idea that makes you want just a tad more. But it's already an over 2-hour movie, so we don't want it to get too overstuffed. And again, I think a hallmark at the very least a real high point for this movie is its leanness in terms of story. It doesn't quite feel over 2 hours. I think it gets, it gets through the runtime without ever dipping too much. And I think, adding much more conceptually probably would have taken us down a less productive road. But yeah, I'm a big fan of this movie. Like the score, although it does get a little kind of, there's some... speaking of the Munson family, in a moment in their farmhouse that gets a little dark and dour and intense, let's say. Some pretty standard kind of horror pulsing tones that were like, okay, well, we're sort of taking some shortcuts to being dread building here. But for the most part, I really like the score, especially there's a little piano motif that plays at one point that's sort of a riff on the X-Men score from the original films. It really works for me. And that final shot, I think there's a gag there that's a little bit
too much. Maybe we'll talk about that when we can free ourselves from spoilers. But, you know, if anybody is listening to this and hasn't watched this movie, I definitely don't want to spoil that for them, because it is, you know, it's a fun movie to watch unfold. I think there's a lot of good stuff here. And part of the discovery is part of the discovery is part of the charm, I would say. For sure. Also, you know, just love a road movie. Love to, even though we don't have big casinos in downtown Oklahoma City, love to get a little Oklahoma City on screen, even if it's in Louisiana, I think is where they, or I Mississippi.
I believe it's Louisiana.
I know that's where they did the farm stuff. Yeah, I did watched some of the behind the scenes stuff. Yeah, they had a hard time finding a casino because of, you know, in that part of the country, all the gambling's on riverboats.
Yeah.
One land-based casino, and then they had to do a huge VFX shot to even get Daphne Keene to walk through the casino because no miners on the casino floor, even for a movie production. So the whole walk through the floor is a big effect shot, which I think is funny.
Interesting.
Speaking of Daphne Keene, I guess I'll leave my thoughts there. Wow. Really good. Glad to see that she's still working. I haven't seen any of the stuff that she's, you know, I know she's in that His Dark Materials show.
Yeah.
She's got something else coming up soon. She's working, but this is what a great performance. And Arthur, you talked about the rage and sort of solemnness that Jackman brings. She's got it all too, man. Just really having a lot of fun, I'm sure. Just getting to scream a bunch, but really brings that pathos and like heartache to this child. Mm-hmm. A really interesting performance, and you know, doesn't have a ton of dialogue, so has to make a lot of, you know, with facial expressions and looks, and you know, kind of non-verbal vocalizations. Mm-hmm. Really fun performance, and you talked about her fight choreography. I agree, it's kind of like luchador stuff. Really cool.
Yeah absolutely. It sort of plays up her Mexicanness. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and just her smallness, right? Yeah. Sort of the high flying aerial type stuff that you see from, you know, smaller performers in that context. Yeah, good movie. Dustin, what about you? Any problems with this?
No, I like this movie a lot. It's a whole lot of fun. And I tell you what it's able to do is a real challenge in franchise filmmaking when you're going to really play with the pathos of a character given the weight of everything they've been through in a series of, you know, a half a dozen movies or whatever before that, is that sometimes you sort of name drop some of those events and it doesn't pay off. I'm looking particularly at, there's an attempt at this, and it ends up being successful later on, but in the James Bond franchise during the Pierce Brosnan era, that there's a couple references to, you know, all those vodka martinis trying to silence all the women's screams that you couldn't save, and, you know, sort of trying to create this kind of broody, haunted version of Pierce Brosnan. And it doesn't work. Now, I think some gestures are made towards this later on during the Daniel Craig era that are a little bit more successful, but they really are just the Daniel Craig movies themselves. It's a much smaller set of films that are sort of like that they sort of suggest a contained world of the Daniel Craig Bonds.
Yeah, yeah.
That sort of is how they're able to get that done, as opposed to Brosnan, where they're trying to say all the Bonds were Brosnan, and it doesn't quite work. And so there are some references to the loss and the grief and the haggardness, the world weariness of Hugh Jackman's Wolverine. And it absolutely works. I mean, there are small references, but he's able to, in the both performance and in terms of the screenplay, able to sort of connect the dots to, we make reference to all these other losses, and the film is able to go ahead and convey that weight so that you can watch the film all by itself and not have the sort of backlog of movies.
Yeah, well, there's no need for, like, specificity, right?
Right.
To, like, it frees it from canon. It frees it from those kind of, those lore hamstringings.
Absolutely, yeah. But if you've got the additional material, it adds the weight, and without it, it doesn't become lighter.
Yeah.
It somehow, you know, it's 100% and 100%, and yet it doesn't equal 200%. It's sort of a mystery there. And that works, I think, in really, really strong ways. And so I really, really appreciate that about the film. I just love the design of, again, the casino that we see, the sort of near future, future adjacent kind of thing that's going on there. I do love the self-driving trucks I think they're really, really great. And yet we still see things that are totally recognizable. And so the horse trailer is the same kind of horse trailer that I saw growing up as a kid in the 90s. And so the way in which the world is still retaining a lot of these objects that we would know, but there's a couple things that are here that are the new modern updates. And again, if we were all to transport ourselves to the future 10 years from now, we'd recognize most of it. And it's able, you know, its ability to sort of capture that kind of future where there are new things, but most of the world still exists from what we would have known just a little bit ago. And so I really appreciate that about it. I do love the way it cribs Shane. Again, this is something that everybody says in reviews, and I won't give much more away about this plot-wise, but I just love the and the referentiality to Shane itself when they're watching part of the movie in the hotel room. It wears it on its sleeve there. And so, yeah, Wolverine's my favorite character from the Marvel Universe, probably. He's just the most interesting character, always has been for me. I don't know, Nightcrawler's a pretty close second, sometimes first, that I go back and forth there. But I love Wolverine. I think he's just fascinating.
Yeah, top five for me, big time.
For sure.
Yeah. You know? It's, yeah, you don't have to think about it at all.
Well, my favorites are kind of all X characters anyway.
Really? That makes sense.
Yeah, I've always cared much more about that.
I like all the deeply sad ones, Daredevil and Hulk, and you know, and this is the appeal of Marvel to me, is like, although, you know, the DC movies have sort of been associated with this dark tone, it's the Marvel characters are suffering heroes in a very real way.
Yeah, well, I think angst is is the best way to describe the X characters especially. And so and Wolverine has always been sort of the angstiest, the angstiest of the X's. And so, just at a time and a place when I caught up with those comics in my life, it was just the perfect timing for me.
Totally.
So, very much love it, very much appreciate it, and think the movie just works on every level. And as you guys have already mentioned, Patrick Stewart is just incredible. That line of, this is the finest evening I've had, and the loveliest evening I think I've ever had, is just incredible. And so,
I mean, that whole scene, him remembering what happened back east, like, yeah, he just is crushing in that scene.
Yeah, yeah. It's so good. So, yeah, we all like I've said the Logan, and then I want to say the Wolverine.
The logo.
The logo. We like James Mangold's Logan very, very much, dear listener, as though you'd be surprised if you've ever listened to the show before to find out that we do. So, now that we know that we all like this movie, we move on to the next part of the show, which is called Expanding the Syllabus. Dalton, can you explain that?
I will. This is where we deliver on the premise of our show. We are going to talk about the films you wouldn't discuss in a film studies course in a film studies type way. So we're going to each program a syllabus involving the film Logan, talk about adjacent films or texts that sort of tie into the film and would work in an educational setting. And we're going to fake teach the movie Logan and try to bring academic discourse to a silly little comic book movie.
Very good, very good. Well, with that, I go to you first. Arthur, what syllabus do you bring today?
I think I want to pick a few movies that will work referentially as inspiration points for what Mangold's doing here, but also just kind of dig into some of the different themes that are taking place throughout the movie as well. And so I think we would start with a story about a man tasked with saving a young woman who potentially offers the hope of the future of civilization. When we take a look at Alfonso Cuarón's The Children of Men, starring Clive Owen and a slew of others, Julianne Moore, Michael Caine, et al., which is just super, super good, about a weary guy just tasked with an unenviable task in a very stylistic, super well-directed, well-shot, well-edited action movie, one of the kind of peak action movies of the 2000s.
Do you know Lessons from the Screenplay, that YouTube channel? I was doing, you know, some Logan research for the show, and they had a video essay comparing Children of Men and Logan. So I was just curious if you had stumbled across that too. Yeah. So, but I'm totally with you. Yeah. The through lines are very apparent for sure.
I think from there, I kind of want to take a look at that Munson family sequence, which where it really does become kind of a horror movie for a little while, and what Mangold has kind of discussed as a important landmark here, and that's the German Expressionism. So we take a look at the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which is also about a murderer under the control of a doctor. And so how that contrasts, we'll take a look at the way those sequences are shot, the framing, the use of shadows and shapes, and how that kind of echoes that German expressionist style of the 20s and the 10s, mm-hmm. and how that impacts what could be a jarring shift, but actually works pretty naturally because I think of the way the emotional beats that happen within that sequence are kind of wrapped up into it. That allow it to not lose any sort of tonal momentum or tonal shift that's distracting or discomforting. So we take a look at that. We take a look at another troubled father-son relationship about a young man caring for his father who has dementia. And we take a look at Alexander Payne's Nebraska, mm-hmm. The quirky indie comedy from Payne with Will... My goodness.
Forte.
Yeah. Thank you. And Bruce Dern.
Bruce Dern's so good in that movie.
Yeah, which kind of brought Bruce Dern back into conversations. And so it's really a blueprint for the Logan / Charles Xavier relationship and as that plays out. And the connection of this being kind of a road movie as well, where we get some of that in Nebraska as they are traveling back home to do some family stuff. So we take a look at that. And finally, we talk about a man going out on his own terms, on his shield, as it were. And we would talk about Darren Aronofsky's The Wrestler and Randy the Ram, who is old and tired and weary, but just wants to live life the way he knows to live life. And we talk about tragic heroes, the point of... what is life? Where is life? And what do I do with life? And, you know, going out in my terms, the way I want to live to be the best version of me that is, I see myself. And that's kind of where we get Logan at the end of the film, mm-hmm. And Randy the Ram as well. And so we take a look at those four films, kind of flesh out some themes, some ideas, some blueprints for Logan, and maybe a little more conversation about some of those different ideas that are present there through these four movies.
Very cool. Very cool. Thank you very much for that, Mr. Arthur Gordon. Mr. Dalton Stewart, you bring a syllabus today.
I do. Yeah. This could either be a class just on James Mangold or a kind of Mangold-centric module in a larger class on genre. But he's really interesting in the ways in which he's like almost always operating as a Western filmmaker, even when he's not explicitly making Westerns. I'd like to use the Priscilla Page article on, I forget the title of it, but she wrote it for Birth, Movies, Death a few years back, and it's an essay on the Mangold film Copland, which is about Sylvester Stallone being a sheriff in New Jersey dealing with the suburban living NYPD cops that are corrupt. And it is very much a Western story set in kind of a modern, you know, Eastern Seaboard, Tri-City area milieu. Mm-hmm. But we would definitely look at Copland, obviously the 310 to Yuma remake that Mangold's done. You know, he's done an explicit modern Western, and we would look at that. And of course, Logan, which is kind of overtly a Western superhero film. And I'd even look at Girl Interrupted, which is not, you know, technically a Western, but it's very much a film about outsiders coming together and trying to operate as best they can, trying to move freely in a system that's trying to impede them, which, again, not necessarily a Western explicitly, but definitely kind of working in themes that I think you can find in these other films. I also forgot Walk the Line, which is kind of also unconventionally a Western, but is very much, you know, about outlaw country and, you know, is about a guy who positioned himself as an outlaw, and both in, you know, sometimes in an acting way and sometimes, you know, by his own deeds. Mm-hmm. But I think all these films kind of work together, and I think you could use them to talk about how malleable genre can be. The YouTube channel Nerdwriter has a great video on Logan as a, you know, a sort of a genre changing film, and he references the John Colletti essay Chinatown and Generic Transformation in Recent American Films. I don't know if you know about this one, Dustin. Did I get that name right? Yeah, John Colletti. But anyway, he talks about four ways. He references the essay, and in that essay, there are four types of genre transformation: burlesque, nostalgia, demythologization, and reaffirmation. And those are the shortened. These got longer
names for each of these different modes of genre change, but those are sort of the shorter, catchier ways to talk about it. But definitely it's interesting the ways in which Logan does demythologization and kind of moves into reaffirmation. And I think we could look at that essay, look at that video, and kind of use that to talk about Logan and these other parts of Mangold's filmography and how he's kind of being very much a cinephile within his filmography and kind of subverting common tropes. Again, he's not somebody who I think people think of as an auteur filmmaker, and yet really there are common themes running through his filmography.
I think absolutely there is an auteurist thread with him, but he's definitely not part of that conversation typically.
And is a visually interesting filmmaker, but I think kind of gets reduced to a journeyman level because he's not, because he'll do The Wolverine and Logan and Indiana Jones, The Dial of Destiny. He'll do those kinds of projects, and he's getting to a point in his career where he's been working on bigger and bigger productions for a long time. So I think it's kind of hard to take a step backwards as a filmmaker when these are the sorts of projects being offered to you. But again, this period of his career, we're kind of talking about the sort of the aughts and tens, where he's working in these kind of smaller to mid-sized Hollywood productions. He is really doing interesting stuff. And I think in this class, we could talk about Westerns, talk about Mangold, and then use Logan to pivot to superhero movies and talk about how those genres overlap, how they don't overlap, sort of from a historical point of view, kind of talk about, how common is the Western phenomenon, or not how common, but how similar is the Western genre phenomenon to the superhero genre phenomenon? How are those different? How is, the share of studios partaking in that genre different? How is the amount of money being made different? How is the dominance of other genres different? So while there's definitely overlap in Westerns and superheroes in terms of good guys and bad guys and, white hats and black hats, and sort of an idea of violence as spectacle, there's definitely a lot that they don't share in terms of the money being made and like the amount of movies being made.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I think that's how we would kind of use Logan, is sort of to position it as kind of a linking film between two different genres.
Very cool.
How would you do it, Dustin?
So I think I would think about this in terms of adaptation. So if I were to teach Logan in this sense, I would be using it in a film theory course where we're working our way through the various sort of theories of film interpretation and analysis.
Yeah.
And just talking about adaptation in particular. And I would assign, rather than my favorite adaptation little essay, which is Robert Stamm's Dialogics of Adaptation, which has come up on a few syllabi in the past, I think I'd use Linda Hutcheon's Theory of Adaptation, where she talks about adaptation as repetition without replication is one of the major ways that she sort of thinks about this, is that there's a way in which, yes, we're doing the same thing that we've seen before, but we're not repeating it exactly beat for beat, word for word. And what is the nature of the changes? What are the natures of the differences? And again, sort of getting ourselves away from, is the book better than the movie? This sort of hierarchy of whatever happens in order. The first thing is always the best thing, and the next thing is derivative. And moving into, now, what is this new thing as its own translation of the original source material? And so I think Hutcheon's really sort of brilliant in her approach there. And so obviously Old Man Logan, the Mark Millar graphic novel, would be the source material that we're looking for here in Logan, which is significantly different in several ways. And again, the way in which you take the ideas, to take the concepts, and then what do we have rights to? We think about those sort of strictures that are being placed on what's allowed for making that kind of adaptation.
Well, God, with this one, you also have to talk about how rights have changed since its original production.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And then what's going to happen, with this perhaps Jackman return, and what's going to be the next thing as it comes down the pike. Then moving on, I want to think about A Study in Scarlet, the Sherlock Holmes story, next to the first episode of the BBC Sherlock, starring Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman, which is Study in Pink, which is this sort of very disloyal and yet very interesting set of apps. And I really like BBC Sherlock, and a lot of people think it's garbage, and that's fine. But I like it a lot. I think it's very, very enjoyable. And I think it's cinematically interesting as television. And it works for me on a lot of levels. And it is a different kind of adaptation, though. It's obviously a contemporary update. But it is, again, keeping certain beats, but also translating those to different kinds of beats that you would make in the same kind of way. And in fact, I'm going to go out and say it. I think Studying Pink's better than Studying Scarlet, mostly because the lack of sort of Mormon prejudice that is a major plot point in Arthur Conan Doyle's story, in his little novel there. So I don't care for that very much. Then we'd move on to, again, artistic visions, authorial kind of visions and voices, I think is an interesting thing to think about. And looking at the two adaptations of The Shining from Stephen King's original novel, the sort of well-lauded 1980 film directed by Stanley Kubrick, and then the later on miniseries where Stephen
King has more of an authorial stamp of approval.
It does, yeah. And doesn't quite work as well for a number of reasons. Mm-hmm. But I mean, not that it's bad, but it's just a different thing. And the ways in which those differing visions can sort of play their way out into different modes of translation. I think that's a lot of fun and really something that's just fairly fascinating. The last thing I think I might look at is an effort not to translate, an effort to sort of be as loyal as possible. And think about Kenneth Branagh's adaptation of Hamlet from 1996, which cuts two lines from the play.
And is still transposing it to a different setting.
Yes, it's 18th century rather than 15th century.
And yet is pretty much,
word for word. Yeah, Kenneth Branagh got nominated for an Academy Award for adaptation on this, and for best adapted screenplay, and I'm just like, you cut two lines, bruh.
I want to see that screenplay. So you got a lot of shot direction within the screenplay.
I mean, you'd have to be. There are some places where the monologues get moved, so the characters are by themselves, so it makes more sense. So there's a little bit of that happens where he's played around with it, and then visually, you know, Hamlet's running through the woods trying to catch up with the ghost of his father, and a monologue he has is sort of moved there so that he can be thinking these thoughts, and then finally has a conflict with his father's ghost. But for my money, I don't care for the movie at all. I think the set design, costume design is brilliant and gorgeous. I think the photography itself is beautiful, but it just doesn't work. There's just too much there.
Yeah.
There are smart things Olivier did by cutting huge chunks of the plot out to make that 50s version that he made, which is obviously a comment on European politics of the World War II era, which, I mean, makes a lot of sense. The indecision is what causes destruction.
Sure.
Makes sense that you'd make that kind of movie
sure.
right after World War II. And so there's a lot of reasons for that. But thinking about adaptation that tries so hard to be quote-unquote faithful and how that can be a real problem. And again, I think Branagh's Hamlet's a good example of a problematic, super faithful adaptation.
I thought you were going to invoke Snyder and Watchmen or 300 because we were in the comic book realm. And I like the pivot to Shakespeare.
Because I don't care for Snyder.
I know you don't care for those movies either. And that's kind of why I thought you were going.
Yeah, it's like if I'm going to do comics, I'm going to stick with the Logan, which is good and different. But, you know, is it better if you had this sort of She-Hulk world off to the West Coast, you know, and this versus this Magneto realm versus this other realm?
Dustin's referencing the plot of Old Man Logan, the comic book, you know, for those of you not in the know.
And so that's all gone from this, and I'm glad of it. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I think it's a right choice. And of course, the properties themselves don't make sense because we don't have X2 in this one. We have one of the Spider Girls. I forget which one, you know, that's there. And those changes are welcome. For sure, for sure. And also Hawkeye. There's so much more Hawkeye in Old Man Logan.
He's like his like buddy. He's the one he's on the road trip with,
Professor
right?
X.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the thing that's going on there. And so those changes, I think, are all for the better. Although we do see that version of Hawkeye a little bit in, what is it, the second of the, is it the Endgame movie that we see?
When he's running around
and doing the Ronin thing. This is the Hawkeye with a samurai sword in this as well. Yeah. And so I feel like that's referential to the other piece there. So, but anyway, it doesn't, my point is, I think it's fun to think about adaptation and adaptation theory in terms of this. So there you go, dear listener, your syllabus just got much longer, but I think now it's time to get down to business.
It's business. It's business time. I know what you're trying to say. You're trying to say it's time for business. It's business time. Ooh, it's business. It's
all right, guys. Well, it's business time. Shall we do some analysis? What do we want to talk about? For, I mean, there's plenty here.
There's a lot.
So what's on your mind? What's your pleasure?
Why make an R-rated comic book movie? Why make
good point?
Why make a superhero movie for grown-ups?
Well, there are some great superhero movies for grown-ups.
I think so.
Like The Crow.
Yeah. I think Super.
Short list.
Super, the James Gunn movie. That's weird.
Oh, yeah, that's fun. I like that. Yeah. I like Super.
I haven't seen it in a long time.
Watchmen, you've already referenced.
Yeah, an interesting failure, like a kind of a grand failure. And I kind of admire that about it. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, not a film I love.
We respect big swings.
Yeah. Reach exceeds its grasp, but that's, Reach exceeds its grasp, but that's fine.
And speaking of like hyper literal adaptations, that's again, that's why I thought you were going to invoke it. Other than some big changes, you know, giant energy blast instead of a alien squid or whatever, with, you know, kind of that key exception, very much very the close, same story. Yeah. Very close.
Right on, yeah.
Except when Zach has to be Zach and blast Hallelujah, which I feel like keeps coming up lately.
Yeah.
We can't stop talking about that
we're
scene.
We're so frustrated with that.
But anyway, I'm trying to think of some other examples of, I guess... You know, Snyder was very much trying to make more grown-up superhero movies when he was shepherding things over at DC with, you know, Man of Steel and BVS and even his cut of Justice League. I mean, definitely those are more grown-up films. Joker is technically in this conversation.
It is more adult in that sense, too,
even
I
though
think.
It's not really a superhero movie.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, there's very much a way tonally. I mean, The Dark Knight and Dark Knight Rises are both very much adult movies. Like, you know, we don't really get the plucky...
I don't know. They're spy movies. I mean, they feel like Bondy movies to me. I don't know.
They are four quadrant blockbusters, but I get what Arthur's saying. They are much more dark in tone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like The Godfather.
Yeah.
I mean, The Godfather's PG-13, right? It's...
Is it?
If it was,
I got you. Yeah.
I mean, this is the idea of, I mean, kids aren't, you know, kids are going to see it because it's got Batman in it.
Yeah.
But the story is very much an adult story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I got you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sort of post 9/11 stuff.
Yeah. It's about corruption and politics.
Yeah.
And certainly,
and
Joker's Batman Begins.
Committing terrorism and assassinating.
Yeah.
Executing.
Very scary.
People on TV.
Yeah. Well, and there's a certain slow burnness to Batman Begins, too, that really would test the attention spans of a 13-year-old boy. Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess we credit Nolan then for at the very least this sort of the slow march towards, you know, an attempt at making a quote-unquote revisionist superhero movie.
It was a weird divide in 2008, right? When we get...
Yeah, big time.
I mean, Iron Man and Dark Knight.
Yeah, it is.
The split in the road.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Definitely. Well, and sort of the cementing of what I was talking about, there's this video essayist account that I just became aware of called Eyebrow Cinema, and I was sort of invoking his essay on how superhero movies aren't Westerns. And again, it very much gets into the stats. You know, like, let's look at 2008 forward, how many superhero movies were in the top 10 versus, like, let's look at an even longer period, like the 30s through the 50s, how many superhero movies were in the top, or Westerns were in the top 10. And the numbers aren't even close. Like, it's nuts. And sort of, it is interesting just kind of...
That the superhero is more popular than the Western was then?
Ever.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Just, the domination is just, like, so much more complete. Like, while Westerns were a reliable picture, like, he also talked about just, you know, greater variety, right? There's B-Westerns and revisionist Westerns, and the only reasons they were even able to be revisionist Westerns is because there was already a tradition of B-Westerns, and also there's not a complication of IP with... You know, there have been non-IP superhero movies, and they've not been very successful. You know, they're you know, Super being one of them, Fast Color being another one from much more recently.
Yeah. I liked Fast Color.
A lot of people need to catch up with it. Yeah, but I'm part of the problem. I didn't see it because it didn't have, you know, it wasn't getting my attention. It didn't have a multi-million-dollar marketing budget.
Well, there's also this weird thing, I think, from audiences. If it's a superhero movie not based on a known property, it almost feels maybe like a knockoff, maybe. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like,
it's exactly.
There's an artifice there that's, oh, this isn't a real comic or whatever. Yeah. Which I think, you know, they're just trying to be the X-Men, or they're just trying to be whatever.
Mm-hmm. Whereas in the 90s, you have multiple Wyatt Earp movies going at the same time.
Right.
And that's not a problem because that's a real person. There's no IP, you know, lawyers rallying around the Earp family or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Disney's Wyatt Earp.
Yeah.
we haven't mentioned Blade. I mean, Blade's a big part of the R-rated
Sure.
Yeah,
superhero movie thing.
Well, and I, you know, it's so interesting, right, how important that film is for making superheroes viable at the box office again. Because, you know, you have this moment that we've talked about a lot, this post Batman 89 moment where the lesson is, oh, let's not make superhero movies, let's make 30 serials into big budget movies, which is just very interesting that that was the lesson that generation of executives took from that film. But yeah, it is weird that like Blade is sort of this moment where, oh, something like the X-Men could be a box office sensation, something like Spider-Man could be, and yet, as you say, that's an R-rated film marketed towards adults and teens. So it is interesting that is sort of the jumping off point for this moment of, you know, the start of the moment of superhero movies.
Yeah, and I think bringing it back to Logan and the idea of the adult comic book
movie. To what
extent
is this an adult comic book movie? That's the question we need to ask now.
Totally.
Though.
Well, I think it's a question of adaptation as well, because the big cry out from the internet, between this and Deadpool, like these are the mm-hmm. two markers, right? Deadpool comes out a year before mm-hmm. to be, you know, the big thing was there. It's got to be R-rated. You got to be true to the character. It's got to be R-rated for Deadpool. Yeah. And that was a big part of, you know, to be a proper adaptation, to be true to this character, it has to be rated R for the violence, for the gore, for the blood, for the language. To make it a real Logan movie, it would have to be. I mean, that's a big part.
But to what extent is it all that gory? I mean, yes, he does stick his, you know, claws inside the head of a dude. A
couple
of
dudes.
We see X-24's head blown off. We see a guy get decapitated on screen.
Multiple dismemberments.
I'd say it's gory.
I'd say it's one of the most violent films I can think of.
It's John Wick 3 violent.
I think even it's more violent than the John Wick films, in that the John Wick films are often like a CGI, you know, head squib, right? Yeah. Like those films can honestly be almost James Bond-esque, like in terms of, yeah, there's more blood in a John Wick movie, and sometimes they'll even dip their toes into body horror, but especially like John Wick 4, like it's almost Bond level in the amount of people being shot with next to no like actual like carnage left behind by the
right. That's what I was. I guess I was just thinking. I've seen a lot of recently, a lot of 80s, you know, exploitation sort of gorehound horror, and some of the Hellraiser movies again. And
I guess,
it's not that.
Sure, I guess this is. Very right to invoke that. We should say this is very violent for a mainstream film.
Correct. Yeah.
That's not a horror film.
Yeah, this is not pushing the envelope in
terms
of violence.
Not that there's not mainstream horror. Yeah,
but it's pushing the envelope in terms of what you do for a mainstream
for
a
superhero.
Trying to make a superhero blockbuster. Right?
Yeah, and it is, you know, a huge talking point in the production. If you watch these behind the scenes interviews, they really did take this seriously, and it's interesting to me the philosophy they had on it, because they even, I think it was Mangold, or it could have been a producer, but somebody like specifically says it wasn't about making a more explicit film, it was about making a more adult film. And I think that's a very interesting ethos that they have on it. And I don't know how successful they are, because the violence is like pretty fucking cool. Mm-hmm. As somebody who is a little bit of a gore hound, like, I think it's pretty sick.
Yeah.
When he like stabs that dude in the goggles, and just like there's a huge geyser comes out of his head for a second.
It's fun.
Pretty dope. He chops the dude's arm off, and his detached arm discharges the shotgun, and that's what makes him go berserker rage, is that his lease got shot. That's cool. It's funny. And so I wonder, like, how successful is it at being quote-unquote adult, at taking the violence seriously? Because there are moments where it'll linger on a body, but, like, do we get all the way to being, like, thoughtful with the violence? What do you think?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure. I mean... It does. I mean, because it's just so much, right? It's just body after body. I mean, to the point of, I mean, like Wick, I mean, there's just, we're stacking up bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really resonating on that as much, mm-hmm. right? Maybe a bit with, you know, he tells Laura, you can get away from this. You don't have to do this. Mm-hmm. But that's really about as, I think, deep as it gets with the violence.
Yeah, there's just a couple of little throwaway lines where, like, yeah, you carry this with you.
I mean, Logan is inherently violent. I mean, you know, as a character, as a person.
It's a character that has knives in his hands.
Yeah.
Oh, and that is another thing they talk about, of course, in the behind the scenes. It's like, we've done, because some of the folks that worked on this movie had worked on, you know, the Wolverine, and some had even worked on earlier X-Men films, I think. And it's like, you know, you do so many movies with a guy that has knives in his hands, and if you have to operate within a PG-13 rating, there's only so many things you can do with the action set piece.
Right.
So it is kind of interesting how it was creatively freeing for sort of the stunt team and the effects team in that regard.
I think it's interesting to think about this R-rated. Is it adult? Is it kid? Or, you know, not kid. Is it
big grown kids.
Younger.
Yeah. 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 Adolescence may be a good way to put
and
it.
And then, you know, having this conversation, but thinking back to the early 90s mm-hmm. when we are monetizing and franchising and toy lining and video gaming, Terminator,
right.
Alien, mm-hmm. Predator.
Yeah.
I mean, hard R movies.
Films, yeah.
Yeah. Very hard R movies that were very much marketing towards kids.
It's such a weird
era. So it's weird
yeah.
that like
yeah, those RoboCop toys, especially, you know, come to mind. Yeah.
I think we can take the violence out of the equation of what, because I mean, you know, thinking back, you know, I watched a number of, you know, the movies I watched with my dad were Rambos and Schwarzeneggers and, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. And so I think it becomes a question of story about, you know, this man suddenly becoming a father, having to transport his dying father, mm-hmm. you know, across the country. Is that the story for the adolescent?
And I think at that level, it does succeed at least part of the time, right? Because you have these scenes of him dealing with this ailing father figure, trying to be a caretaker to somebody who has dementia. And there are moments where those scenes like real are kind of profound and like are more adult drama scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, you're right. He has to like reckon with this child who, you know, yes, she's traumatized by having her skeleton filled with metal, but she still is
like you do. You know?
But if we accept that as the reality of the film,
we all know that that's a tough day.
Of course. Yeah. And if that's all happened to us, we all have those stories. But if we can accept that fiction, this is this child that's very traumatized that he has nothing but a biological connection to and has to try and form some sort of connection and you know, develop a relationship. Yeah. That stuff is at the very least gestures towards being adult. Right. At the very mm-hmm. least, you know, these it's about family. It's about, you know, parents and children. And so in these moments, it succeeds. And yet we get to the Munson house and we don't really have anything for that family except to murder the shit out of them.
Right.
Pretty graphically. And it does nothing but motivate the plot forward. We don't really there's no like big moment for Logan or Laura that comes out of the events of the Munson household.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of get a sad moment on Logan's face. As, you know, Mr. Munson, like, attempts to fire on him, realizes his shotgun is empty, and then succumbs to his wounds. And that's kind of as close as we get as Wolverine having a moment where he's like, oh, man, I brought all this carnage to this place. And he says it to Charles, like, we're bringing a risk on this family by being here. And he's right. And the film doesn't really reckon with that.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting to me.
I mean, and again, that is the Shane piece of the movie in mm-hmm. which Shane is not fit for, you know, living amongst normal people. He just can't do that. And that's sort of why he has to do what he does.
A clone of Shane doesn't storm in and murder everybody, I imagine.
I mean, this is where they comic book it up, though. There is this idea that there is no possibility of them just hanging out with his family, mm-hmm. living here, and pretending at something of a normal life for even a season. Like, that's just, it's just not optional. This is how entirely isolated. And I think narratively that works. And so to have it be this family that we just get a beat of, they're a good family, they've mm-hmm. got a good life together, mm-hmm. you know, and you showing up and being in it is just, you're just a pestilence. You're a wave of destruction, and that you've got to get away. And that's something that Logan seems to have internalized into himself. That's what I am. I'm a disease.
That's true. And he does
everybody
have
I get close to.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And he has
and
that.
We get that line with Laura later. And she's like, well, I guess you won't have to worry about me.
Yeah. Oof. That's
everybody I care about dies. Yeah. Like, well, I guess I'm fine then, huh?
Yeah. Oof. God.
Yeah. It's such a good line.
Such a good line. So, yeah, you're right. It works narratively. It works thematically. I guess for me, it's just really dramatically unsatisfying.
Yeah.
You know, and that's maybe my only like real quibble with the film, because I think even the idea of X-24, right, having this literalization of the violence of Logan, the, you know, the they wanted to make me a killer idea, and having this version of him devoid of soul that's stronger than he maybe ever was, I think is interesting. I think it feels a little, I don't know. I wonder if it's a little clumsy, you know, because just it is event again very comic booky and a somewhat restrained movie in most other respects. But I think like as a narrative device and as a dramatic device, I think it's compelling for me. Right.
Well, I think the sort of rug pull that it is mm-hmm. when you first see, you don't realize that that's what it is, right?
Yeah,
and that works. I think that's fun. for just a second there, and then it's, oh, this is obviously evil Logan, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oof. God, that scene where he kills Charles is so heartbreaking. Just devastating, truly. This feels like it's part of the tradition of road movies in a way that's like really great. And it follows the thread of those types of films by, you know, the characters have to change their external world as their internal life is morphing, right? Like, and that's kind of a hallmark of a good road movie for me. And I think this film definitely like sits very comfortably in that canon of like using the screenplay to propel them along constantly. You know, things are happening and therefore other things are happening, right? Or, but another thing is happening, right? It's not just an and. It's these characters are changing because of the things that are happening to them.
Yeah.
And there's you know, the propulsive force is moving them forward and like keep continuing that growth and that change and continuing the like the changing the world continues to change around them too because they have to stay on the move. So it's just good. You know, for me, it just, that's just stuff that works.
Yeah. And I think again, ties back into that Western DNA of the, you know, the cattle drive north or the westward expansion. Totally. I think Lonesome Dove, right? Where we've got these characters who are trying to go north and they all get split up and they all have to face challenges they didn't expect, which changes them. And they become friends with people they wouldn't expect to, or they get meet fates that they hope not to. Right. And I think it is kind of a part of that same migratory tradition.
Totally. Ooh, yeah. I'm glad you invoked Lonesome Dove. Yeah.
So I'm just out of curiosity. Have either of you seen the New Mutants movie?
Yes. Sort
of. Okay, you've seen it. Now, is it a movie in which it has the actual New Mutants characters, or is it these kids?
That no, it's magic and at all Wolfsbane and
Wolfsbane. Okay.
Yeah.
I was curious if it was the actual New Mutants or not.
I think
so.
Mirage.
Because I mean,
it's actual New Mutants.
I think because that's a movie I'd watch.
I think you're one of the few people that remembers that's a real movie, Dustin.
I watched it.
Yeah. I yeah.
Something. It's on Disney or HBO or
I'm sure it's on Disney Plus. It ought to be.
They all are now. Yeah. I think they're part of like Marvel Legacies, have the branding or something. Yeah. Yeah. But I think even this movie's on Disney Plus now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wild.
I think you'd like New Mutants.
No, I probably.
But yeah, I mean, it's magic and. Okay. I mean, it's the team.
I like all those characters. Yeah. I mean, I have some of those comics from the 90s. Yeah.
It's not Richter at all.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I do want to pivot back to the violence just like a little bit. Just kind of want to get like a poll on it. Like, how do we feel? Is it just kind of cool and gnarly? Is it doing anything for you at a level of like making you take things more seriously? Does it make things feel more grounded? Or is it?
Well, this is one of the places where the Western of it doesn't, I don't know what extent, because the Western always sort of makes this idea that, you know, there's these bad men that are not fit for society. You know, your Ethan character from The Searchers or Shane from Shane, and the way in which that it was okay for a moment, for a time, but now that time has passed is sort of the general thrust of the Western genre, sort of meditation on this idea of violence. And this movie just like, well, and it was just time for this one to be this guy. He's done all of his violence. He's very sad, but he's also kind of a hero. Mm. We'll remember him. And now a new tribe will grow up and become very efficient in the distribution of violence ourselves. And off we go. It fails to have sort of the, we've got to get past this kind of
thing. I think that's the movie's hope, though, is that the kids will be able to get outside of the violent lifestyle.
Somebody attacking them, yeah, but they're going to learn it so that they can fight them off if they come back, aren't they? Isn't that...
Well, Logan's one of his final lines is, don't be what they made you, right? You know, so he's encouraging them to find a life of peace.
And I find the violence that X-23 Laura hands out to be the most troubling because she is a child.
Yeah.
Yes.
And a raging killing machine. But, you know, for me, that's... we don't often see violence against children in movies, especially in genre stuff, you know.
Sure.
And don't often see children delivering violence.
Mm-hmm. Certainly not vampire kids occasionally, but it, right?
And so I think there's something much more hard to watch when that's the realization.
Well, and her performance is so compelling, right? Like the rage seems so bottomless and real.
So yeah, I think that makes it even more kind of troubling. I mean, he definitely, Dustin, you were talking about the Western of it all, and he definitely kind of sits in this hard man archetype that we talk about mm-hmm. a lot. Like, but and yet this man has a heart of gold, of course, right? That he's like trying to ignore, and that seems like so. I mean, it makes sense to build sort of a Western adjacent film around this character because he does feel so much kind of beholden to that those archetypes.
Yeah, man with no name kind of person. Yeah, seems for sure.
Yeah, the man who comes into town and, you know, gets swept up in heroics, even though that's not the kind of person he sees himself as.
There's also this weird way which I think he gets to live out the mission that Charles started, right? The first X-Men movie ends with, you know, Charles telling Eric, I pity the poor soul that comes to the school looking to harm these children. And Logan kind of gets to carry that out here.
Yeah.
You know, in a weird way to finalize that legacy of Charles Xavier and his school for gifted children.
Well, and that final line, this is what it feels like. And it could be so many things, right? This is what it feels like to have a child. You know, this is what unconditional love feels like. This is what it feels like to be Charles. This is what it feels like to feel like you've done something and you know, helped the next generation.
Yeah.
That cross should really just be laid over his neck the entire time. It feels a little silly to pull it out of the ground and lay it on its side.
Yeah.
That was a moment that really worked for me in theaters.
Yeah.
That
it's like a fun nod.
My friend like kind of scoffed at it. I was like, yeah, you're kind of right. Like, you're undeniably right. It makes sense that
she would do it because the comics.
Yeah,
right?
Totally.
But it is a very cheeky
it's
wink.
Too movie. Yeah, it just maybe.
Well, and there's that sort of metatextuality throughout that there's a world in which they have made X-Men comics, that this is sort of, you know, part of what's in the comics is what they're living, and that's kind of, it is cheeky.
But he's by the water, just like Charles.
Oh my god, when he's like can't get through, he's trying to like eulogize Charles and he just can't. Oh my god,
that's so
and
good.
She what? She delivers the Shane monologue.
Yeah,
at Logan's.
Pretty badass. This is a line from that Nerd Writer video about genre changing, you know, trying to redefine genre. This is a line that I really like. I just want to write down the way that violence can complicate superhero movies. No personal moral code can wield power without risking devastation. I had to write that down. I really liked that, and I was like, that's tasty, because that is sort of the problem with superhero movies, right? And I feel like if at any level Logan succeeds, weirdly it might even be in the same ways in which something like The Boys succeeds, which is by just bringing into the equation having this sort of ability to tear a regular person limb from limb, whatever that the method of your power distribution is, whether it's laser eyes or knife hands or super strength, it is sort of a profoundly upsetting idea.
Yes.
And I think like the ability to judiciously distribute your personal moral code far and wide is kind of horrifying. And I think that there is at some level when we see something turn the dials up on the violence like this, or, you know, The Boys or some other examples, I think that the very least makes us think about these things, makes us consider lines like Zemo's line. And if for anybody that checked out Falcon and the Winter Soldier, there's that good Zemo line that calls to mind Alan Moore talking about superheroes as sort of a white supremacist ideology. And then Zemo in that TV show even says that the desire to be superhuman cannot be separated from supremacist ideology.
I mean, it's an interesting idea.
Yeah, I think that's what bringing the violence like forces us to think about.
Which is one of the interesting things about this movie that sort of divorces itself from some of that X-Men DNA, which is that it's built out of the civil rights movement. And that there's sort of that's entirely really missing here. This is not like this sort of oppressed, we're trying to be ourselves kind of group. That it really just works into this sort of conspiracy theory, government program, metahuman kind of thing.
Yeah,
right?
We don't get sort of the mutants as queer coded thing, you know, the born this
or
way
racially
stuff.
Coded. Yeah,
whichever. But yeah, both have been used throughout the history of these characters quite a lot. You know, the only thing we get is, you know, this kind of almost thrown away sci-fi concept that Richard E. Grant's character has been responsible for. You know, Mr. Munson talks about the genetically modified corn and soft drink and syrupy drinks or whatever. And then we get the reveal that Richard E. Grant has been responsible for genetic therapies in energy drinks or something, which is sort of like a really got a goofy note in the screenplay that's kind of tossed offhand.
Mm-hmm.
But it is weird, like, oh, okay, so the fiction of this movie is that Richard E. Grant, over the last generation or so, took over his dad's research, who was, you know, one of the alkali guys that weapon-X'd Logan in the first place. He's taken that research and found a way to remove genetic mutation from the population.
Right.
So it is, I don't know, that's as close as the movie gets to being like, oh, hey, remember how the X-Men are about being persecuted? We got kind of one note of that. And mm-hmm. they don't exist anymore because this guy gene therapied them out of existence.
Right. I mean, that simplicity is fine, you know,
yeah.
Because
oh, yeah.
It becomes just the sort of, we've got to shepherd this, you know, yeah. small group. And
a new group of mutants exists, and it's only because of this guy's nefarious
deeds.
And
it's the future that Magneto always feared.
Yeah. Yeah.
As well.
Which is kind of weird that he's not invoked at all, because you're right, it is exactly like the only mutants that exist are weapons for the government. Which is extremely tragic and isn't really, yeah, like you said, Dustin, isn't kind of dealt with in the same, not that any of the X-Men movies like really get into it with much nuance, but definitely less than some of those other
Far
ones.
Far less, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a fair critique to have.
The other thing I just wanted to mention, I guess, before we sort of wrap it up with this movie, is the mutability of superheroes, not mutation ability, but the mutability of them to transpose to different kinds of genre trappings. Like
it's a crime movie with Batman.
Right.
It's a Taxi Driver with the Joker.
Yeah, it's a spy movie, you know.
Yeah.
It's a World War II drama.
Yeah.
It's a Western. It's, you know, there's a real sort of portability of mm-hmm. these characters into whatever sort of trappings you want to lay them on, right?
Which often tends to lead, I think, to the more interesting versions rather than just trying to adapt the story, you know, wholesale.
Because the first 2/3 of the Wolverine is the Samurai Logan movie. And yeah. You know what? I'm there for it.
And then it becomes a comic book movie. And
right.
We get the giant CG bad guy or whatever.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first 2/3 of the Wolverine are really cool. I think yeah. really interesting. We get to see a little bit of a nerfed Wolverine there because of the poison or nanonites or whatever it is that's slowing his body down.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah.
Oh, the spider thing on his heart. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
I think the more interesting stories are those that just get to play with genre and then say, what if a superhero
mm-hmm.
was here
mm-hmm.
in this scenario?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's just fun.
Yeah.
And I think that allows a little more creative freedom, you know, and it's hard to know. I mean, we've gotten a lot, but I feel like in comparison to the MCU, you know, most comic movies we got are DC.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we haven't gotten a lot of outsider to really kind of play with that idea more, you know, other than Batman, other than this. I wish we could see some more of
that. Yeah, because I want to see that DCU Darkest Night. I want to see a handful of DCU superheroes fight zombies. I mean,
yeah.
That sounds like a good movie and a good time, you know?
Yeah. Well, I saw Mangold's doing, has signed on to do Swamp Thing.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, fun.
That could
yeah.
be fun.
Be fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's what, an eco thriller with Swamp Thing in it, you know, I mean,
yeah, sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think what makes the character of Logan work so well in this context, you know, of this sort of more, what if a superhero was here? He's a very human character. He's very traumatized by, like,
mm-hmm.
he's a being that has lived for like 200 years, can't die, is been, you know, in multiple militaries, has killed a lot of people, a lot of them not really by choice. So to have this character who's like canonically a drunk, you know, an alcoholic and barbiturate addict, and, you know, guy kind of stricken with post-traumatic stress disorder, like, it really gives a human face on this idea of the power that we've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like, not only is his healing factor nerfed, right? Like, not only are the characters, you know, superpowers being hampered, but his like emotional interiority is hampered. Like, his ability to get out of bed in the morning is hampered. And I think that's like a really kind of fun place to see this character start, because it just does make things feel more, you know, it does succeed at making it feel like a more of an adult film, you know, and that definitely seems to have been one of the North Stars for this production, was to make a more adult superhero movie or comic book movie, however you want to frame it. And I think that's a a success in my eyes.
Yeah, totally works. Well, let's go ahead and render a verdict then, which I don't think we'll be too surprised to hear. What do we say, shelf or trash on the film Logan, Arthur?
Yeah, I'm going to drop the Hebrew hammer right on the table next to this before I put it on the shelf. Yeah, easy.
Very good, very good. What do you say, shelf or trash, Dalton?
It's a pretty spectacular movie. Yeah, and if you're a freak and you want to see it in black and white, you could buy it and do that. I mean, they've got two versions of this movie. I don't know why you would do that. I did the same thing, Arthur. I watched the opening in black and white just to see how it looks.
Very cool scenes. Yeah. Like, there's some cool shots, cool scenes. But by and large, it just...
Well, in that first sequence, with the Cholos and the stealing off the hubcaps or whatever, like, that's... Yeah, that makes sense for noir.
Yeah. That was the part that I watched. And I watched a little bit more, and the further I got into the movie, I was like, this really does need to look like a Technicolor Western.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's definitely worth owning. It is, again, if all superhero movies tried this hard to, like, be good... that they might be more interested. So, you know, at the very least, they tried to make a real motion picture. You know what I mean?
I mean, yeah, if this was setting up 10 different TV shows and another four movies.
Just make one good movie.
Yeah. That's all you ask.
That's all you need. Just make the movie the thing.
Make a good picture.
Yeah.
There are one-shots in comics for a reason.
Yep.
Yes.
And this is one of those. And yeah, and there's a reason that they kind of took that idea to a movie. And it divorced it from continuity, allowed it to stand on its own, to be its own movie. And it's much more successful for that. What do you think, Dustin?
I also think shelf. I think it's great. It's a lot of fun.
It's the first time in a few weeks.
We did it.
This is John Wick 3, at least.
Yeah.
So tell us why we're wrong, dear listener, and Dalton will tell you how.
That's right. If you think this movie's a piece of shit, I follow quite a few people on Letterboxd who have given this 2 stars or less. Oklahoma City's very own Ray Gunn Bush from Chappile, not a fan of this movie, according to Letterboxd. I know, right? This feels like it's up his alley.
It does feel like, yeah.
Right? Anyway, if you don't think this movie's good, let us know. GoodTrashGenreCast@gmail.com. That's the place to send your long-form feedback. Any thoughts on the show? GoodTrashGenreCast@gmail.com. Hit us up. Let us know what you think about this movie or anything else. You can also find us over on Elon Musk's progressively worse website. But hey, on the plus side, now we don't look less respectable for not being verified. We're
a good company now.
Yeah, exactly. Now we look cool.
Only schmucks have a check mark. Is that the rule?
That's right. Or the people that he's weirdly personally paying for, like LeBron and Stephen King. What a strange, sad little man. Anyway, if you want to find us on his website, we're at Good Trash Media. You can find links to this show, other podcasts that we collaborate with, like The Wheel of Randy or The Praise Down, or just, you know, cool stuff that we find, whether it's, you know, a fun listicle or a good review, or just really funny movie tweets. We try to keep the feed interesting. That's at Good Trash Media if you want to follow us on social. Last but certainly not least, if you want to contribute to keeping this show on the air, you can go to patreon.com/GTM and find out what's in it for you. Stuff like picking a movie for us to talk on the show or having us send a movie to you for your viewing pleasure. That's patreon.com/GTM for more info on that. Arthur, I assume part 3's part Trey continues next week.
Yes, that is a marathon, and that is how it works.
I suspected that would be the case. So,
those are the rules of the marathon.
What? How shall we continue this marathon?
Well, we're gonna pivot real hard next week. Real hard.
Real hard.
Real hard.
Okay.
But next week, we do get to talk about martial arts. Okay. When we take a look at Kung Fu Panda 3.
Yes!
Now, do I need to see Kung Fu Panda 2, Dustin?
No.
I've only seen the first one.
I think you're fine. Kung Fu Panda 2 is good.
Yeah.
It's maybe the best out of the series.
But how do you feel about 3?
I feel like 3 is fine.
Okay.
And the whole series, it's on par with the whole of the series. It's very, very entertaining, fun children's film.
Well, I look forward to Jack Black and James Hong and host Angelina Jolie come back for this one, too.
I believe she's back, yes.
Damn. Got a good cast for the Kung Fu Panda movies.
Really is great. Yeah, Jackie Chan as Monkey.
Yeah.
So, you know.
All right.
Good time. So, there you go. You keep watching. We'll keep talking. And we'll see you all next time. I'm not sure. I'm not afraid.